Z-Trim Appetite Control is perfect for taking the edge off hunger.
I lost 6 pounds the first week and never felt hungry.
I lost a full pant size.
I've lost 15 pounds in 2 months without dieting.
Without dieting.
You're hearing the success stories of people who have discovered Z-Trim Appetite Control. Developed by the USDA, all-natural Z-Trim helps you feel satisfied before you eat more than you should.
I can breeze through work without distracting hunger pains.
I don't have to exercise, and I still eat the foods that I love.
Z-Trim Appetite Control is a healthy way to help manage your weight regardless of diet or exercise.
I simply take 2 capsules before each meal.
Z-Trim Appetite Control is fantastic.
For people who need to manage their weight with limited physical activity, Z-Trim provides a naturally healthy option.
To order Z-Trim Appetite Control capsules made with USDA-developed Z-Trim, go to ztrim.com. That's ztrim.com. And enter the code word NATURAL for a 10% listener discount. Or call 1-877-MY-Z-Trim. The only thing you have to lose is weight.
Some reports are issued and just gather dust, but to show you how important this one is, I read it. Very important report. And a very important part of our a new way forward in Iraq.
God. Our new way forward in Iraq. We'll get to all that tonight. Bush and Blair held a conference today to discuss the Iraq Study Group report, which means we have, yes, indeed, moron sounds on the program tonight. If you can handle it, listening to Bush talk about the Baker Hamilton report today was like hearing a fifth grader try to do a book report on a book he hasn't read. Bush just keeps referring to the title. The Way Forward. It's what he said he liked best about the report. The title, The Way Forward. Everything's important and forward and will prevail. Forward. These are the Karl Rove words of the day. Yes, Rove is still around. It's just that the establishment power decided that Rove had screwed up so badly that he should stay out of sight for a while so that we forget that that worm still operates inside the heart of democracy in this country. It's kind of pathetic, really, listening to Bush parrot some of these words. Bush answered one reporter's question about the value of the Iraq Survey Group's report by claiming it was so important he actually read it, which you just heard. Unlike most summaries, which Condi has to fashion into some kind of large print, simplified coloring book version without any big words or nasty realities in them. He read it. That's how important it was. I got a report and I read it. All by myself. This man is so stupid, he makes my teeth hurt. But we will we will let you decide that for yourself this evening when we get deeper into the muck of the program. Today is Pearl Harbor Day, 65 years ago today. As reported by the Associated Press, one by one aging survivors from the ships that were sunk in Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, laid wreaths under life preserver rings honoring their ships. Nearly 500 survivors bowed their heads at 7:55 a.m. the minute planes began bombing the harbor in the attack that pushed the U.S. into World War II. NBC Nightly News, former NBC Nightly News anchor Tom Brokaw, the author of The Greatest Generation, spoke at the ceremonies there today. He said, quote, America in an instant became the land of the indivisible. There are so many lessons from that time for our time, none greater than the idea of one nation greater than the sum of its parts, end quote. Yeah, but we had a president then, not a doofus, not a clown, not a freak, not a stupid man. We had a president, and we had a people that knew that Democrats were Democrats and Republicans were Republicans. Well, you know. Now, for many of these veterans, this is it. This is the last return to the World War II attack site. A guy is quoted in the AP story, a seaman first class who was aboard the USS Arizona this day 65 years ago, and he said, you know, there's not too many of us left. In another 5 years, I'll be 89. I might be able to make it back here, but I might not be around. Who knows? Japanese veterans who participated in the attack as navigators and pilots also paid their respects. There are some of them left, offering flowers at the Arizona Memorial for the Americans and the Japanese who died. Japan lost 185 men that day. Some Japanese veterans and American survivors have reconciled in the decades since. Japanese dive bomber pilot Zenji Abe has apologized to American survivors for the sudden attack, ashamed his government failed to deliver a declaration of war in time for the assault. The Japanese aviators who carried out the attack thought the declaration had already been made by the time they started bombing, Abe has said. Compare that, whether it's true or not, compare it to Bush's attack on Iraq and his attitude. When I was a kid growing up, I can remember my mother telling me about that attack, where she was at the time. Same way people my age remember where we were when we got word that Kennedy had been shot, and where people in a newer generation will remember where they were when they heard that the trade towers in New York had been hit by aircraft. My mother said it was chilling all those years ago, because for the first time in American history, we were attacked in what we considered to be our territory, even though Hawaii was not a state then, and how scared everyone was. But both my parents, who were together at the time, and my father at the time was too old for the draft, they went to work in defense plants, and my mother told me that the war, when all was said and done, it was the war that pulled the United States out of a depression, and it was the war that united what were becoming very serious fissures in American society between the haves and the have-nots. So a slightly different take, I guess, from Tom Brokaw's, but very weird. We're going to start tonight with what Bridget at fairywoodland.com sent to me the other night. It was very interesting. And I got something from Rick along the same lines. And you may find this interesting. I certainly did. I seem to remember, after reading both lengthy emails, which I'm not going to force on you at all, but after reading both lengthy emails, I seem to remember hearing about this at some point. I've made no secret of the fact that I have done mind-altering drugs at various times in my life under fairly controlled conditions. That means out in the woods. I used to know people who would do acid and go to a disco. Jesus God. Or eat mushrooms, psychedelic mushrooms, and go to a football game. No. So, yeah, I've made no secret about the fact that I have done organic hallucinogenics. And usually in following, what's his name? The one who wrote The Natural Mind. Say it again. No, the... I'm drawing a blank, but it'll come to me. Following his advice that set and setting have a great influence on how you're going to react to psychedelics. Set, referring to your mindset, what do you expect? And setting being where you do it, where you do these drugs. Dr. Andrew Weil, who wrote The Natural Mind. And as I've said before, Weil's position was, if you are going to do psychedelic drugs, okay, but the real way to experience that is through meditation and deep meditation. So while Weil does not advocate drug use, he certainly sees it as one of the many doors of perception you want to walk through. So when I saw this story again, it kind of triggered something. I remember reading about this a long, long time ago. So I think you'll find it interesting. It certainly puts a different take. I think on Santa Claus, I think most of us understand St. Nicholas was a, depending on whose legend you want to believe, was a Turkish priest who, depending on the version of the story, brought gifts to a dowry for a woman about to be married whose family was too poor to have anything. But he was in Turkey, which is far, far, far away from reindeer. There are no reindeer in Turkey. There are no sleighs to speak of in Turkey. So what's the connection here? You know, I think you'll find this interesting. Stick around. We'll do it right after the break. I know we're not talking about Iraq and we're not talking about death and destruction. We'll get to that a little bit later in the program. I'm Mike Malloy. This is Nova M.
Sometimes get encapsulated in a bubble.
Oh, be careful with that music, Cabot. All right, so this is what Bridget sent me. She was doing some research a couple of years ago. Her husband was working on a stage production that included the history of Santa Claus. And she writes that she thought she'd send me some not very well-known information that she loves to use when anyone gets in her face about the sanctity of Christmas and its symbols. Now, let me jump aside from her email. I think most of us know that the more visible symbols, other than the baby in the manger, are all druidic or Celtic. The burning log, the holly, the mistletoe, the lights, the gift giving, the partying, going from house to house, singing songs, the tree itself. These are druid symbols and ways of enticing, getting through the long northern nights and enticing the sun to return. This has nothing whatsoever to do with the baby Jesus or the Christian religion. Nothing, zero. But what happened, as I'm sure most of you know, when Christianity expanded, especially across northern Europe, it just simply incorporated the local mystical legends that the holiday traditions or whatever was being celebrated or honored or caused fear. All of this was just simply incorporated into the Christian mythology that was moving inexorably across Europe. So anyway, starting with Bridget, excuse me, she writes, turns out that precious and revered symbol, Santa Claus, which no Merry Christmas shouting fundamentalist would be without, is actually a psychedelic traveler who flies after drinking reindeer pee. This is not a joke, Mike. Please read on. It seems there's good evidence the origin of the Santa figure comes from the fur-covered wild man of Lapland, where reindeer roam and munch on the mushroom Amanita muscaria. This is the gorgeous red mushroom with white spots we always see depicted with elves and fairies hanging out around it. This mushroom is famous the world over for being used by shamans because of its strong hallucinogenic properties, but it has some poisonous components which make it a little tricky to use. It seems the Lap people, hence Lapland, the Lap people figured out that when the mushroom is consumed by the reindeer, their digestive systems metabolize out the more toxic components but leave the hallucinogenic elements intact. So when the reindeer who have eaten the mushrooms pee, they are excreting a very hallucinogenic substance that no longer has toxins in it. Enter the shaman of Lapland and Siberia. They would ingest the mushroom or the reindeer pee and drum themselves into a trance where they would fly, quote, quote, to the other world to communicate with the spirits. Sleighs pulled by reindeer, a real feature in that part of the world, so it's not surprising that the shaman's mode of transportation to fly to the other world would be the same. There is a flying sleigh and reindeer symbol that is painted on most shamans' drums. So the theory is that when the first missionaries reached Lapland, they heard stories of such reindeer flight and integrated those tales into the existing Christmas lore of Western cultures concerning St. Nicholas. Rudolph, with your nose so bright, won't you guide my sleigh tonight indeed? As a matter of fact, have you got a little mood music? Yeah, play some of that, would you, Kathy? I just need something to get me in the mood here.
Ho, ho, ho! Gather round, my reindeer. It's foggy tonight. I think maybe we might need a guiding light.
Rudy, Rudy, guide my sleigh tonight.
Rudolph the red-nosed reindeer. Had a very shiny nose,
like a light bulb.
And if you ever
saw it,
you would even say it glowed
like a light bulb.
All of the other.
More recently, it's been suggested that the Siberian use of fly agaric may have played a part in the development of the legend of Santa Claus too. At midwinter festivals, the shaman would enter the yurt, the hut of Siberian people through the smoke hole and down the central supporting birch pole, bringing with him a bag of dried fly agaric. After conducting his ceremonies, he would leave the same way he had come. Ordinary people would have believed the shaman could fly himself or with the aid of reindeer, which they also knew to have a taste for fly agaric. Santa is now dressed in the same colors as the fly agaric, red and white, carries a sack with special gifts, comes and goes via the chimney, can fly with reindeer, and lives in the, quote, far north. Now, there's more to Bridget's email, but let's move over to Rick's now. As soon as we come back from this break, stick around. This is good stuff. I love this. This puts a whole different spin on the Santa Claus story.
So bright, won't you guys?
Border to border and coast to coast, The Mike Malloy Show. All substance, no abuse.
26 before the hour. We're just doing a little Santa Claus thing here momentarily. Watch that music. This email, like I mentioned earlier, we got two back-to-back emails pretty much. One came yesterday and one came today from Bridget at fairywoodland.com and from Rick, who both are talking about the same thing, the psychedelic connection between Santa Claus and, or the connection, I should say, between Santa Claus and shamanism and how that connection was bridged with the use of psychedelic mushrooms. Rick writes, in anticipation of your flying reindeer story tonight, I've linked you to a YouTube posting of the BBC documentary Sacred Weeds. It was a four-part BBC series covering four psychoactive plants, fly agaric, salvia divinorum, henbane, and blue water lily. The link I sent to you is the fly agaric, and it is in five parts. The BBC makes far more interesting documentaries than we do here in the U.S. I don't suppose you'll devote much time tonight to the subject of psychedelics, but Of all the liberal talk shows, yours is the one that could get away with it. Psychoactive plants should not be a taboo subject in the year 2006, but we live in strange times. Can we in America, Rick asks, even have a serious clinical discussion on this subject without being typed as one of those crazy liberals by the flying monkey right? I suppose not, but to hell with them. Not that the story of a baby godman being born to a virgin is crazy. Oh, no. Here are some interesting facts. Shamans drinking reindeer urine after the reindeer had eaten the mushroom. Fly. Flying is a common vision the fly agaric induces. The reindeer apparently like the intoxication, too. Shamans carrying a supply of the mushrooms in a sack as part of their healing medicine. Thank you, Santa. Little people, i.e. elves, fairies, leprechauns, sprites, dwarves, are common throughout the shamanic legends. Red and white, Santa Claus motif, the fly agaric is red with white spots. In Siberia, there are legends of the shamans in winter that entered a home through the smoke hole when snow blocked the entrance to the dwelling. The fly agaric mushroom goes under pine trees, presents presents under the tree. Nature's gift to man. In Germany, the famous red and white fly agaric or agaric mushroom is a popular Christmas tree ornament. I got to say that the clincher for me for the psychedelic Christmas connection is the legend of drying the mushrooms over the fireplace, as they are far more potent when dry. This was the tradition long ago in the village huts of Siberia. For the record, I personally have never taken a psychedelic. I lived the psychedelic life vicariously through 60s music and keeping up on 11-dimensional M-theory while occasionally reading the personal anecdotes of others who have braved the way into chemically altered states of mind. I have in me so much hatred of the so-called conservative ideology and its pure destructive power that I really am afraid to ingest a psychoactive substance for fear of that hatred being mirrored back to me. I've read much on the psychoanalytical power of hallucinogens and how profound the experience can be, and I believe it. Would I be the guy with snakes crawling up my pants? Just don't want to take that chance. On the other hand, being an artist, I love to experience beauty through nature, art, music, science, math, and of course sex, so maybe my experience would be truly wonderful. I'm so obsessed, Rick writes, with the psychedelic Christmas connection this year that the other day I sent a couple of rather bizarre Christmas eel messages to people I thought might appreciate them. I wrote them of the symbolism of many Christmas traditions to that of the shamanic fly agaric legends throughout Europe and Asia. I got no feedback from them, so thanks in advance, Mike, for at least mentioning the psychedelic connection. Again, assuming that is your intention. Signed, Rick, a psychedelic wannabe. You know, doing that is certainly a person's an adult person's personal choice. You should prepare if you're going to do it, but the shamanistic approach here to explaining Santa Claus, this kind of does it for me. It really does, because I've been very familiar with the Saint Nicholas. And did the Catholic Church, 20 years ago or so, de-sanctify Nicholas? I think the saint that was supposed to be the guide for travelers? Saint Christopher. Saint Christopher was de-sanctified, I think. Saint Nicholas was de-sanctified. Can you imagine if you're a saint and all of a sudden, and you're flying around in saint land and all of a sudden you feel this ripping, pulling sensation and you go flying through 12 dimensions and land upside down in a mud patch and you say, what the hell just happened? And this big boy says, you've just been desanctified. Whew, man, that's rough. But the connection between this Turkish priest who, according to one legend, gave out gifts to dowry gifts to a woman so she could get married. Yeah, they were doing it even back then. And the flying sleigh and the reindeer and so on and so forth. Where does the connection come from? Well, it's been settled for me. Thanks to Rick. And thanks to Bridget. Now, wasn't that fun? Kathy, hello. Kathy's asleep.
Makes me hungry.
Makes you hungry. Oh, my goodness. Rick, as far as your own journey inward, what Moody Blues said, you got to make the journey out and in. So, good luck. Bush. Oh, God. Do I have to do this? I do. All right. I was with a rock band one time, and we did mushrooms in their van. That was awful. No, wait. Oh, Bush. Right, okay. You know, in listening to Bush today talk about what the Iranians have to do, one of the suggestions... This is really difficult. One of the suggestions by the Iraq Survey Group was to get together with Syria and Iran, regional talks and discussions, you know. And Bush just gets so furious, he like wets his pants when he talks about Iran. Oh, and by the way, did you read that thing? And I printed it off today, and I can't find it. James Baker III was asked how Bush reacted when he was handed this report and kind of skimmed it. And Baker made the unusual, was it Lawrence Eagleburger who made the statement? Okay. Eagleburger said that Bush was had been drinking early in the morning. He said he was already blasted. I think for those of us who have seen him drunk on camera or drugged, this does not come as a surprise, but it's just one more huge ball of hypocrisy that comes from these bastards. You know, the demonizing of gay folk and then and working diligently to deny gay folk the right to get married or adopt children or have children of their own. And Dick Cheney's daughter Mary and her partner are pregnant. And the Cheneys are very happy. Oh, God, I hate them. I hate the Bush crime family. Anyway, Bush admitted that it's bad in Iraq. The last time something like that happened, a star appeared in the east. Bush admits that it's bad in Iraq, but we're winning. The news media, it's their fault. They never report on the children flying kites and all the schools that are opening. Maybe it's because they open just long enough for bombs to go off and kill a bunch of children. I don't know. But today, Bush said it's bad in Iraq. But his focus on Iran, it makes absolute sense. Bush has set up Iraq and Iran for the first time in a very long time, a natural alliance between the Persians and the Arabs, who happen to be Sunni. Now, Saddam was secular. He claimed to be a Muslim, but that's like Hitler claiming to be a Christian. But Bush has bridged the gap. What George W. Bush has done is he has provided a huge handshake between the government and the people of Iraq and the government and the people of Iran. Oh, and the terrorists in both countries. So it's all one family now. This is what Bush has handed to the rest of the world. If the rest of the world has reason to be fearful of such an alliance, which I don't particularly think the rest of the world does, or would find it necessary to be fearful of such an alliance, if the rest of the world treated the situation between the Israelis and the Palestinians in a more even-handed manner and worked diligently to solve that problem rather than to allow it to fester since 1948. But I digress. So Bush gets his bloomers in a wad over Iran's nascent nuclear program. Does George not understand that for more than 50 years, or roughly 50 years, of the Cold War between the United States and the Soviet Union, we dealt with a country on an ongoing day-to-day basis, diplomatically, culturally, socially? We dealt with a country, a collection of countries, i.e. the Soviet Union, that targeted our cities with massive nuclear death, and still do, and somehow managed to get through it so far. So his arguments about Iran's nuclear program is once again bat squeeze.
You're listening to Resistance Radio with Mike Malloy.
So Bush is all upset, and he's not really. He could not care less about Iran's nuclear program. The argument by the neocons is the Iranians don't need a nuclear program because they sit on the third, fourth, fifth, sixth, I don't know, largest supply of known oil resources. And the Iranians' response is, first of all, it's none of your business. Secondly, we want to use nuclear energy rather than burning fossil fuel. But for 50 years, you see, during the Cold War, we dealt with the Soviet Union's nuclear reality. And to this day, right now, as you and I are sitting here, we still target their cities and they still target ours. Now, by that I mean, they're not on hair trigger alert like we were for probably 30 of those 50 years, but they're still targeted. What do you suppose happened to all those missiles out there in South Dakota and North Dakota and Arizona and wherever the hell they are? What do you suppose happened? They were all decommissioned? Nobody still sits in the Titan missile silos anymore? With the two magic keys, the two keys that unlock the rabbit hole, huh? Do you think that there are not missile silos in various former Soviet republics that are now part of the Russian Federation or whatever they call themselves, and especially in Russia, Siberia, missile silos that contain, in the case of the Russians, and this is enough to make you stay up at night wondering when Santa Claus is going to show up with his magic mushrooms. These missile silos in Russia are slowly deteriorating because the country has had 10 years, 15 years of no money to upgrade them. But Bush says, well, if the Iranians want to talk, they know what they can do. They can get rid of those, whatever you call it, that nuclear interest. And the incoming, this is interesting, the incoming U.S. Secretary of Defense Robert Gates told a Senate committee yesterday or today that Israel has nuclear weapons, and this partially explains Iran's motivation to acquire nuclear weapons. Well, duh. See, we're not supposed to talk about Israel having nuclear weapons because the Israelis won't confirm or deny. Robert Gates told the Senate committee during his confirmation hearing, quote, they, referring to Iran, they are surrounded by powers with nuclear weapons. Pakistan to the east, Russians to the north, Israelis to the west, and us in the Persian Gulf. So what are the Iranians going to do? They're going to build a bomb! You're damn right they are. You know how many of us, and I use the first person plural, us, not first. I don't know what the hell I'm talking about. I use the pronoun us because a lot of us have tried. We tried for years the anti-nuke movement, the nuclear freeze movement. I've got pictures on my wall at home of photographs of me and other people participating in anti-nuke demonstrations to go back to the 70s. And what has been accomplished? Nothing. Absolutely nothing. So given that reality, the Iranians are going to say, oh, well, that's okay. India has it. Pakistan has it. Russia has it. Israel has it. The U.S. has it. God only knows who has it. We better get it too, because the North Koreans have proved that the only way you can stop American aggression is to own your own nukes. So to hell with George Bush and to hell with everybody on his team who talks about Iran having to declare itself a nuclear-free zone before Bush will talk to or allow them to sit at a table. I would imagine that Ahmadinejad, as wacko as I think he is probably sitting there going, go screw yourself, Bush. What, you're going to tell us? We're a sovereign nation of 90 million people. We will build what we damn well please. You don't like it? Bite me. Problem is that Bush might, unless he's restrained by something or somebody, maybe Santa Claus. Maybe he and his wife can get drunk and just kick back and just say, how the hell with it? I don't care if you have nuclear weapons. Don't bother me. I'm out of here in two more years. What are the girls doing tonight? Running? What country are they running across tonight? Hey, whatever happened to Chelsea Clinton? Bush says the U.S. needs a new approach in Iraq. We need a new approach. And he admitted today that it's bad in Iraq. It's bad in Iraq. Vladimir Putin, with one phone call and about 10 minutes, can activate or put on hair trigger alert. Probably pick a number, folks, because no one really knows. 80, 100, 200, 500, 1,000 nuclear-tipped multiple warhead missiles targeted on the United States. Just a phone call.
Da, put the missiles back on hair trigger alert.
But Bush says that he has looked deep into Putin's eyes and seen his soul. So it's okay. Putin, the guy that sends murderers, assassins all over Europe to waste people and leave a radioactive trail that's wiping more people out. Have you been following how many people are sick now with radiation poisoning? Putin, Bush's doppelganger or soulmate or other half or separated at birth twin or something. But this freak Ahmadinejad who says, okay, we're going to make nuclear reactors here. And if they scarf off enough plutonium to come up with a couple of bombs, oh, well, we live in a nuclear world, George, and your team has made it so. It was your team that never, ever, 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 ever would agree to any sort of non-proliferation treaty. Never. Screw it. Get rid of the treaties. Open seas. Let's have lots of nukes. It's the old theory. George, you know, down there in Texas, you all subscribe to this idea. If everybody is armed, then crime will go down because everybody will be afraid to rob, rape, steal, maim, or do arson. Well, to the rest of the world, you jackass, that's how they consider nuclear weapons. If I have them, the United States won't attack me. And you know what they use as prima facie evidence of that fact? Iraq. Six and a half past the hour. Welcome back. Okay, Bush today with Blair. What is shocking to me, I guess, every time I see it, especially with these two together, because like most Americans, I automatically assume someone that has an upper-class British accent is intelligent. I guess that's a holdover from the days of empire, right? Or certainly the days of pre-revolution in this country, where people with that with a British accent subsequent to the revolution were seen, I don't know, as our betters. Huh? You know what I'm talking about. Not that any of that's true, but when you hear that British accent, don't you make the assumption, a certain British accent, that the person using that accent is just a tad smarter than, say, you are? So listening to Blair, who is so far beyond Bush in terms of intelligence quotient as well as his understanding of international relations as to render what Bush says is just a fourth grade gibberish. I'm sorry, fourth graders, I mean no offense. But to listen to Tony Blair answer a question at these joint press conferences that these two have had, and then listen to Bush answer a question, is astonishing. Astonishing in the difference between tone, pronunciation, attitude, a factual basis for even standing there opening one's mouth. Remember the first joint press conference these two had after They spent the night together at Camp David, and the first thing out of the geek's mouth was, "How we both use Colgate toothpaste." Pepsodent? Is that what? Oh, thank you, Kathy. So there they were again today. Bush admitted that it's bad in Iraq. He said, quote, "I do know that we have not succeeded as fast as we wanted to succeed." He's still just absolutely delusional. "We haven't succeeded as fast as we wanted to succeed" implies that there has been some sort of success. And the only success has been to the private contractors and to Dick Cheney and to the oil companies and to the war-making establishment in this country and in the UK. The arms manufacturers, the purveyors of death and destruction, they have had success. An email from Jamie says, "I agree with one thing Bush said today. Iraq is in a region." Right, he said that. I caught that too, Jamie. Iraq is in a region. So, after the opening statements, the first reporter asks if Bush is going to follow the Baker-Hamilton recommendations and get out of Iraq by 2008. Naturally, Chucklenuts won't commit to that. It just spouts some generalities about how great the Baker-Hamilton group was. "These are good Americans." But he won't make any comments about what he'll do in Iraq, probably because, as most of us know, he has no intention of ever leaving that poor, sad, decimated country until the last drop of oil and blood is wrung out, or until somebody tells him what to do. Like, oh, I don't know, Dick Cheney? Reporter says, "Mr. President and Mr. Prime Minister, neither of you has shown much doubt about your Iraq policies. Do you acknowledge that your approach has failed, as Baker Hamilton suggests? And are you willing to engage directly with Syria and Iran and pull out most combat forces by early 2008 unless there's unexpected circumstances?"
The thing I liked about the Baker Hamilton report is it discussed the way forward in Iraq.
See? See?
And I believe we need a new approach. And that's why I've tasked the Pentagon to analyze the way forward.
Yeah, right. Uh-huh.
And the Baker-Hamilton report did some very interesting things. First, it shows that Republicans and Democrats can work together to achieve and to come up with a strategy to achieve an objective.
Jesus.
And the Baker-Hamilton Commission showed it's possible for people of goodwill to sit down at the table and design a way forward, of course. And so that's why I'm sitting down with members of Congress to say to both Republicans and Democrats, this is an important cause. It's important for our security. It's important to help lay the foundations for peace. And I want to hear your ideas. And I thought the report did a good job of showing what is possible.
Can you stop with the bat squeeze for a minute? The reporter asked you a question, you halfwit. Do you acknowledge that your approach has failed? Are you willing to engage with Syria and Iran? Are you going to pull out most combat forces by early 2008? Not, he sounds like a fifth grader trying to do a book report based on reading the book's title and the back cover blurb. Raisin Brain has no idea what's in the report. He has no idea his policies have failed. He is a delusional, maniacal idiot. He says, "I want to hear your ideas." This is what he said about the UN before he went around them and invaded Iraq against their advice. He doesn't care about anybody's ideas. He listens to God. God talks to him. God talks to Osama. God talks to Bush. God talks to Ahmadinejad. God used to talk to Sharon until Sharon's ears got all plugged up. God talks to all of these people. Kill. Invade. Kill some more. Ohio State by 10. Do some more killing. Watch out for the North Koreans. The Chinese want to sell us stuff. Or sell you stuff. I'm not, you know, I'm God. He hears God. Invade. Kill. So what does this vague comment He just puked out onto the stage. What does it mean? Other than tons of taxpayer dollars wasted on this Iraq study group, since obviously you're not going to pay a bit of attention to its conclusions, not much. So typical of this unfeeling, uncaring, dry-drunk sociopath, Bush makes a joke out of the killing and maiming and destruction and bloody carnage he created in Iraq. A British reporter says, Mr. President, the Iraq Study Group described the situation in Iraq as grave and deteriorating. You said that the increase in attacks is unsettling. That won't convince many people that you're still in denial about how bad things are in Iraq and question your sincerity about changing course.
It's bad in Iraq. Got help?
Why did it take others to say it before you've been willing to acknowledge it to the world?
You know, in all due respect, I've been saying a lot. I understand how tough it is, and I've been telling the American people how tough it is, and they know how tough it is. And the fundamental question is, do we have a plan to achieve our objective?
Hell
are we willing
no.
to change as the enemy has changed? And what the Baker Hamilton study has done is it shows good ideas as to how to go forward. What our Pentagon is doing is figuring out ways to go forward. But there's a lot of, you know, very important things in the report that we ought to seriously consider.
Uh-huh.
And so I view this as a very, a important way forward.
Uh-huh.
With important concepts.
Yeah.
And the American people expect us to come up with a new strategy to achieve the objective which I've been talking about, and which is laid out in the Baker-Hamilton report.
You half-wit, the American people just handed you and your party a slap on your ass at the last elections. The American people do not expect you to come up with a new strategy to achieve the objective. What is the objective? Winning? What is winning what? Winning with whom? The Shia hate us. The Sunnis hate us. The terrorists hate us. Everybody in that part of the world hates us. What is your strategy? What is it that you think the American people want? We want the hell out, you idiot. What's he been doing? Drugs like Limbaugh, and now he's destroyed his own hearing? What, the earpiece is getting in the way? What the hell is going on? Go forward. Important things. The report has important things. Keep repeating the title of the report. Maybe you'll convince your brain-dead ditto heads that you know what you're talking about. Oh, it's a good report. A lot of good things there. It's important report. I've been talking about all this stuff. You know, I have. And it's all laid out in the Baker-Hamilton report. Which one of my advisors from which I get good advice to, whom I listen, will explain to me one of these days.
No, I've always, you know, a dictatorship would be a heck of a lot easier. There's no question about it.
So Bush is all riled up with the reporter, or reporter from the UK is questioned about, essentially, you know, are you still in a state of denial? Are you still out of touch with reality? Do you yet understand the horrible nightmare you created in Iraq? These ramblings about winning and success and prevailing are the delusions of a madman.
Make no mistake about it. I understand how tough it is, sir. I talk to the families who die.
You do?
I understand their sectarian violence. I also understand that we're hunting down Al-Qaeda on a regular basis.
No,
and
we're
bringing
not.
Them to justice.
No, we're not.
I understand how hard our troops are working. I also believe we're going to succeed.
Oh, my God.
I believe we'll prevail. Not only do I know how important it is to prevail, I believe we will prevail.
I understand how hard it is to prevail. But I also want the American people to understand that if we were to fail...
You failed!
And one way to assure failure is just to quit. Is not to adjust and say it's just not worth it. If we were to fail...
You have failed.
That failed policy will come to hurt generations of Americans in the future.
You've done that.
I appreciate it. As you can tell, I feel strongly about making sure you understand that I understand it's tough.
It's tough.
But I want you to know, sir, that I believe we'll prevail.
Say prevail.
I know
again.
We have to adjust to prevail, but I wouldn't have our troops in harm's way if I didn't believe. One, it was important. And two, we'll succeed.
You're the reason for all this suffering, Mr. Bush, sir. Don't lay that at anybody's feet but your own. You murderous bastard, this was your doing. The rest of the world said no. Government said no. The people said no. Prime ministers, presidents, and dictators said no. Future generations will be digging out of your disaster. You caused this. You did it. But you can no more accept responsibility for your murderous actions. Do you know how much is on your soul, Mr. Bush? Do you know when you go to face your Jesus, he's going to slap the living hell out of you and then cast you into hell for all of eternity? Do you know that? That's what you have done. You've committed mass murder. I don't think you're supposed to do that, are you? Thou shalt not kill? Delusional. Sick. Couple more here from Mini Mind to show how out of touch he truly is with reality. This reporter says, back to the issue of the troops, is it possible to get them out of Iraq by early 2008, as the report talks about? And when do you hope to have this report?
You mean, when do I hope to announce the strategy? Is that what you're talking about? After I get the reports. And Baker Hamilton is a really important part of our considerations. But we want to make sure the military gets their point of view in. So, Steve, we're spending a lot. I'm heading back. We spend a lot of time considering the new course. Because the decisions that we make affect, lives.
Lives, man. Hey, the decisions we affect, that we make affect, lives. Cool. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Is it time for what? We want to make sure the military gets their point of view in. Dumbass, your new Secretary of Defense says we are not winning in Iraq. What more is there to consider? What part of not winning do you not understand? Chuckle nuts. Not, that's a fairly easy term. Word or term, pick one. Winning. As in, it's not a winning strategy. My God. He says we're spending a lot of time considering the new course because the decisions that we make affect, lives. Yeah, we know. We know how your horrendous, out-of-control decisions have affected lives, even if you don't describe how you talk to dead families. I talk to dead families, I talk to dead families, and God tells me when it's time to kill more people. So, This is an atrocity.
smithereens.
C'est si bon de partir n'importe où, bras dessus, bras dessous, en chantant des chansons. C'est si bon.
You know, when Bush makes these comments about he understands the American people and this is what they mean, he doesn't speak for the American people. He never has. He never has. This man has yet to be elected president of the United States. You can't be reelected if you were not elected to begin with. He doesn't speak for the people of the United States. He speaks for a small, relatively speaking, cadre of religious right neoconservative freaks. So stop pretending like you speak for normal people. Prairie 2 says, hey Mike, it is telling that the Iraq Survey Group would reveal publicly that Chucklenuts is a drunk. These guys aren't about truth-telling. They would only say this as a step in building a case. They aren't here to rescue W for Pappy Bush. They are here to take him out. This would explain why Pappy is having crying jags and why the Democrats have no interest in mounting an impeachment. They know he's gone. The extreme right, the only people who still support W, are thoroughly hosed at him over losing the war. The Bush crime family and the person of the 10 dwarfs is here to put him down. It's an interesting, interesting take. Back to the press conference, the joint press conference with Tony Blair today. So Bush is so off kilter, and his ridiculous answers have him off balance. He can't remember the other parts of the questions. Excuse me, that was a Diet Coke coming back to haunt me. He can't remember the other parts of the questions, which was about the Iraq Survey Group's recommendation to remove troops by 2008. But he asked the reporter.
Is that the third party question? You've got to stop these long questions, Stephen. Stephen. One of the things the report did mention, and I think you said it in your comment, that if conditions so allow, and, we want our combat troops out as quick as possible. We want the Iraqis taking the fight. And as the report said, I don't know if I got the exact words, but it was along the lines that, depending upon conditions, I believe is what the qualifier was, and I thought that made a lot of sense.
Yeah.
I've always said we'd like our troops out as fast as possible. Uh-huh. I think that's an important goal. On the other hand, our commanders will be making recommendations based upon whether or not we're achieving our stated objective.
More double plus ungood news speak that means nothing. So the troops come home when your undefined objective is achieved. Well, that's just great, Chucklenuts. As the report said, I don't got the exact words, but it was along the lines of depending on conditions. You know what he's read when he says he's read the report? He read the executive summary. They do this with every single report that comes from any group in official Washington. There's an executive summary for these kinds of moronic freaks, chairman of Senate committees, members of the cabinet, the vice, and especially Chucklenuts himself. And the executive summary is usually one page. In Bush's case, it's two, because they've got to allow for pictures. He hasn't read the report. I wish one of the reporters would have said, okay, there are 79 recommendations. Name one. But no. They wouldn't say that. This reporter wants to know if Bush will give more consideration to the ISG report than, say, a Pentagon or State Department study, since the Iraq Survey Group was, wink, wink, nudge, nudge, bipartisan and, chuckle, chuckle, independent. The question is, Mr. President, you have said that you have the Baker-Hamilton report. You also have, you say you're waiting to hear from the Pentagon. You're waiting to hear from the State Department. This report was prepared by a bipartisan group, the only one you'll get. Secretary Baker has a special relationship with your family. Shouldn't this report get extra consideration? Does it not carry more weight than any of the others?
It's certainly an important part of our deliberations, and it was certainly an important part of our discussions this morning.
Yeah.
Some reports are issued and just gather dust, and truth of the matter is a lot of reports in Washington are never read by anybody. To show you how important this one is, I read it, and our guest read it. The Prime Minister read a report prepared by a commission.
Yay!
This is important.
Say important.
And, you know, you ask its relative importance. I'd call it
important.
Very important report.
And very important.
And a very important part of our working to a new approach, a new way forward.
Is it important?
In Iraq.
Is it important?
It's a very considerate, important report.
Ah, okay. It's important. It's important. It's very important. The importance of this important, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 times in 48 seconds. Important. It's important. To show how important this one is, I read it. Wow! Jesus, number one, that isn't true. And number two, even if he did, is that something to brag about? Wouldn't the public expect a president to read a report on a war he created? Then again, this is a big step up for Bush from the Bible to hop on pop. I defy any remaining Bush supporter to call this program and explain this juvenile answer. Bush seems to want points for reading the report. I read it. It's important. It's so important I read it. I'm sure, but I read it. A lot of reports don't get read. I don't read any, ever. I get good advice from the advisors who advise me on what to be advised about. I like advice and advise. Advise is good. Advice is good. My advisors advise me, or no. My advice, I listen. I'm busy. Go away. Where are the pictures? I can't do this. Up, down. You want to see my pinky? I got a pet rat at home. Boom, be boom, be boom, be boom, be boom, be boom. How many times can this freak say important in 48 seconds? I counted 9. I read it. I read it's important report. Important report. Hey, that both words have port in them. Important report. Hey, gosh, I had Tony Burr read it. He said it's important report too. Jesus. Any of you right-wingers want to call in and just tell me, if do you like the way your leader sounds? Huh? Do you like this? Certainly an important part of our deliberations, and it was certainly an important part of our discussion this morning. Some reports are important, and some reports aren't important. And the truth of the matter is, a lot of reports in Washington never read to anybody share important. This one, I read it, and our guest read it. Him over there, the President of England, he read it too. Didn't you, Tony? The New York Post today, front page, surrender monkeys. New York Post is owned by this Nazi bastard from Australia, Rupert Murdoch, who owns half the media in the world. This Nazi bastard, Robert Murdoch, Rupert Murdoch, whatever the hell his name is, Nazi bastard. There it is, front of the New York Post, surrender monkeys. Two, I guess they're chimpanzees sitting there. One has the face of James Baker. The other has the face of Lee Hamilton. Iraq panel urges U.S. to give up, which is not true. It didn't say that at all. Did not say it at all. And back in February 2003, just a few weeks before the invasion of Iraq, the New York Post depicted had a picture from the National Security United Nations Security Council. And if you remember, the French and German representatives at the United Nations were depicted as half men and half weasels. Jesus. Surrender monkeys. I would like to take Rupert Murdoch and his rich bitch family, all of them, and strip them all naked and put them in, Samara, Fallujah. and say, now run, you little bastards, run. See how far you can get before you are blown into a million pieces. Surrender, monkey? Try this. Have I mentioned yet tonight how much I hate these people? So Robert Gates told a Senate committee today that Israel has nuclear weapons. Israeli officials traditionally don't respond to statements like the one Gates made, and true to form, a government spokeswoman told the Associated Press, quote, there is no direct Israeli comment, end quote. According to the Associated Press, experts played down the importance of Gates' outing of the Israeli nuclear weapons program. Oh, please. Outing of the Israeli... Oh, what? Israel has nuclear weapons? Really? Damn, I didn't know that. Defense analyst Shlomo Brahm, a retired Israeli Defense Forces general, who was once in charge of strategic planning for the military, said similar statements came out of Washington during the first Gulf War in 1991. It did not lead to a change in Israeli policy. This is nothing really new, he said. It doesn't change anything. Well, no, but with all due respect, Shlomo, it does certainly lend a little bit of gravitas to why Iran wants one.
The objective is yet to be achieved, and we're not leaving until we do achieve the objective. And General Tommy Franks, understand the objective, and we will achieve the objective.
Yeah? Okay. 10 before the hour, let's do some phone calls here. As a matter of fact, let me see, what else have we got here?
Do you have any more amusing stories about urine?
You didn't like that, did you?
The psychedelic reindeer pee story?
Yes.
You know, that's not going to be part of Molly's holiday reading repertoire this year.
Well, it blew off a bunch of useless liberals who are listening to the program tonight. They probably tuned in and said, oh, Jesus.
So what's Mike talking about? Reindeer pee.
Who's this guy, Molly?
Okay.
I thought this Malloy guy was supposed to be this kind of radical left-winger, and he's talking about reindeer pee? You just didn't like that story, did you? I thought it was great.
I was just trying to find the, as Bush would say, the relative importance of the important part of that story.
It's very important.
Did you read it?
I read the executive summary. That's a very important. I'm fascinated by you. You know this, Kathy. You know this about me. I am fascinated by religious mythology, and the stories that are told in these massive, overpowering religions that somehow developed in the minds of human beings. You know, the construction of gods and then God, the construction of the rules and regulations that these gods or gods supposedly laid out, how, you know, darkness was on the face of the deep and the world was without form and void and, you know, all of a sudden, boo, God, you know, that's right there is a perfect moment for the Big Bang. But no, you know, and God saw that the darkness was dark and said, well, let's have light. Wow, man. You know, but especially the way the Christian faith literally bastardized and corrupted ancient traditions, whether they had to do, Easter's another one, you know, just totally corrupt. And Chris, the celebration of Christmas is just so bizarre to me. It's been bizarre to me for probably the past 35 or 40 years. And this year, it's amazing, the those people in media who claim to speak for Christians, you know, Bill O'Reilly and Sean Hannity, and they want to put the commercialism back into the manger. You know, that's the part that just cracks me up. When I was a kid growing up, there was all this bitching and screaming that Christmas, the birth of the baby Jesus, had become so commercialized that it was blasphemy. It was just blasphemy. And I think that's one of the reasons a lot of retail merchants decided to do away with the word Christmas, and substitute holiday. They say, well, it's because, you know, the Muslims usually have something around that time of year, and the Jews do, and, you know, we just want to welcome everybody into the store. No, I don't think so. I think it was because there was pressure 40 years ago to put Christ back in Christmas. So the retailer said, okay, that's fair enough. We'll call it the holiday season. And now, people like this filthy puke O'Reilly and this little bird dog Sean Hannity, now they want Jesus back in the aisles of Macy's. This is insane. It's just insane. It's just crazy. Anything to divide America. Anything to make us look at our neighbor in contempt. Anything to make us suspicious and fearful. God, I hate this. I just hate this. But I digress. As far as the reindeer pee and stories like that, you know, it's fascinating to me. Fascinating. Even like on when we do our Christmas show, by tradition, I read from the book of Luke, the story of the birth of Jesus. And I do that because I just find the whole thing fascinating. I really do. It's like mythology from any religion. It's like a Hindu god is asleep, and that's what reality is. We are part of his dream, and when Shiva wakes up, the earth is destroyed. Everything, all time, space, everything is destroyed. Is it Shiva? Until Shiva goes back to sleep and begins dreaming again, and then a new cycle of reality begins. And with the Christians, it's, you know, shepherds were sitting in the field in the middle of December in somewhere in Israel, like, no, not unless they had huge bonfires. And besides, you know, you don't have your flocks in the field in December. You just don't. And a star comes, and these three kings from the east, and the shepherds, and I mean, it's fascinating, fascinating. That's why I read it.
You know, I think that star was actually some sort of sleigh flying, powered by psychedelic mushrooms.
I thought you didn't like the story.
No, it's just I think we just mix it all up. Just throw it all in there.
Well, when we do the Christmas show this year, as we do every year, we will be reading from Luke, and we will be reading The Night Before Christmas. We're trying to explain to Molly that Santa Claus is really kind of a myth. I don't know how I'm going to tell her it's the result of reindeer pee. We'll wait until she's six for that. We'll be back after the break. I'm Mike Malloy.
Tens and tens of listeners are now feeling very sorry for Molly right about now.
What?
Welcome back. Doug sent me an email. Hi, Mike. Not that it makes a bit of difference, but it was the dreams of Vishnu, not Shiva. Vishnu is the preserver. Shiva is the destroyer, but it really doesn't matter because all the gods are simply different incarnations of Brahman. People don't commonly know this, but Hinduism is monotheistic, and all the gods are simply attributes of the monotheistic god Brahman. These different gods aren't really beings at all, but simply manifestations of the Absolute, and the Absolute is something that is beyond description anyway, because there's nothing. It is not. I've got two words for you, Doug. Reindeer pee. Got to say, I liked the guy, Doug says, on the Baker Commission who said that Bush, what was it, plowed, blitzed, smashed, whatever it was, it's pretty clear Bush is off the wagon and is now more than a dry drunk, but rather is bobbing in a sea of intoxication. Well, who can blame him? He's about to take a great fall. Doug. Oh, Doug blogs at yogaphilosopher.com. Yogaphilosopher.com. Here's a little Christmas story. And by the way, we're coming to your phone calls in just a second. Just let me squeeze this in, and then here we come. And I got a couple of emails asking if on the Christmas show we're going to play O Holy Nightmare. And we will. That's become a tradition on the Malloy Christmas show. Oh, Holy Nightmare. If you haven't heard it, this is from Katy, Texas, which is a, it comes to us via the Canadian press, thanks to one of our Canadian listeners. A plan to build a mosque in Katy, Texas, which is a Houston suburb, has triggered a neighborhood dispute with community members warning the place will become a terrorist hotbed and one man threatening to hold pig races on Friday just to offend the Muslims. One resident has set up an anti-Islamic website with an odometer-like counter that keeps track of terrorist attacks. Since September 11th, the committee has formed to buy another property and offer to trade it for the Muslims' land. Next, our neighbor, Craig Baker, has threatened to raise pigs on the edge of the property on the Muslim holy day. Muslims, of course, consider pigs unclean and do not eat pork. The engineer on this project, one Kamal Futo, said, quote, "The neighbors have created havoc for us, and we didn't expect that," end quote. Katy, Texas, population 13,000, is a mix of middle-class bedroom community neighborhoods and small farms on Houston's western edge, and boasts of being the hometown of Oscar-winning actress Renee Zellweger. It is 70% white and 24% Hispanic. Pig races. One of the residents there, someone named Cynthia Blackman, wrote to a county commissioner and said that the center was a security risk. She wrote, quote, "Would you and your family safely and comfortably live next to this 11-acre Muslim mosque and facilities?" The reaction, end quote. The reaction has not been all negative. The engineer, Fotu, said one man came to the mosque on a Friday afternoon and apologized for his neighbors. Fotu said, "He moved me, really. The sense of fairness, the sense of standing by the underdog." Pig races. Well, that's nice. That's a good thing to do. That shows the Christ-like compassion of 95% of Christians, 98%. Oh, well, not you, if you're a Christian. I know you would never do that. But oh well. All right, phone calls. Will calling from Michigan. Hey, Will.
Hey, Mike. I think we need to start talking about the Iraq War in terms that it's been going on for 15 years.
The war didn't begin on
March 20th, 2003. It began on January 17th, 1991.
Right.
And I think framing it in that context would radically change the debate. in this country. And I know we can't get the media to frame it in those terms because, you know, they have the attention span of a flea.
Mm-hmm.
You know? I just think that this war has gone on far too long, and you know it's gone on longer than I think the Vietnam War did.
No, not quite. It's gone on longer than World War II. The Vietnam War was the war in which we had our longest involvement. I think it was altogether 9 years, officially, from the Gulf of Tonkin resolution to the helicopters sucking people off the roof of the American embassy was closer to 10 years. So the longest war we were involved in was Vietnam.
Well, this war has been going on since January 17th, 1991, and hostilities have never ended.
Right. Well, based on that, then the Iraq War. Now, you were in Gulf War One.
Yes.
Right. Based on that time frame, yes. This this is longer than. This would be longer than any. I was thinking about the Revolutionary War, but I guess not. Unless you want to say that the War of 1812 was just Act Two of the American Revolutionary War. But yeah, you're right. You're right, and I don't know though if it could be reframed that way. That is the truth. The 8 years of Clinton allegedly was a time when there was no war in Iraq, which is a lie. There was almost daily, certainly weekly, bombing runs by the United States and the UK over Iraq, and if the onboard radar showed that that American plane or that UK plane was being painted by ground-based radar, then missiles would be launched. And that's not even talking about the horrendous War Crimes Act of putting that country into a state of siege with the denial of with the trade. What am I trying to say? The
sanctions?
Yeah, all the sanctions that were put on Iraq. And, of course, all that did was allow companies in France, United States, Germany, Sweden, China, Jordan, Israel, Italy, Spain, to make a lot of money by working behind the scenes for Iraqi oil, you know, the oil for food or whatever the hell it was called. Just about every nation on earth cheated on that. There were no good people, knowing full well that the money was not going to the people of Iraq, but rather going to Saddam's Ba'athist Party upper echelon and the Saddam's family itself. So you're right. This is a 15-year-long war, and the death toll in Iraq, all things considered, is probably approaching the death toll of the Vietnamese in the 10-year-long war there, which I believe was close to 3 million. And I think the death toll in Iraq at this point is roughly the same. This is one of the more brutal chapters, I think, of American history. This is up there with the Middle Passage and typhus germs put into blankets and given to Native Americans. I mean, this is really bad stuff. And I appreciate you pointing it out.
Thanks.
All right, Will, take care. Take care.
You too.
Yeah, that's an excellent point on a subject that has nothing good to say about it. But it's Will's absolutely right. And I think also in reframing this, we should not leave out the 8 years of Clinton and Madeleine Albright and Al Gore. I'm sorry, Al Gore too. I mean, these people were responsible for the deaths of hundreds of thousands of Iraqis who had done nothing but have the misfortune of being born in a country that was ruled by Saddam Hussein.
Has he mentioned yet tonight how much he hates these people? It's more Mike Malloy.
Yeah, okay. I hate them to the breadth and depth and width. My heart, something, something, something. Back to your phone calls. Harry is calling from New York. Oh, my God. Are you a flying monkey, Harry?
Hey, Mike, nice way to stall the clock.
What?
Listen.
Stall the clock? What do you mean?
Well, you got complaints with everybody. You don't like the Republicans. You don't like the Democrats. I think you just don't like this country just like you don't like God. And what are you going to do on Christmas reading out of the Bible, you atheist?
Well, I read out of all kinds of religious texts. Don't you?
I don't think an atheist should be touching that Bible.
What will happen if I do? Will it make you burn up?
No, you can do it. Let me tell you something. I've never been so proud of my president as I am right now.
Yeah, why?
I don't know. I just know that he's a great American.
Yeah, how? Way to go, Harry. Yeah, we didn't hang up on Harry. Harry started to wet himself and you know, had to hang up real quick before he electrocuted himself, too. Oh, my God. What was that? You atheist. You damn atheist! Whew. Lee is calling from Oregon. Lee, welcome to the program. This isn't Lee Hamilton, is it?
No.
Oh, okay.
That's what I wanted to talk about. He's a disgrace to the name Lee.
Okay.
Well, I've been listening to the sound bites all through the day,
yeah.
And him going through about the loss to America, and then he'll read out the number of dead soldiers and wounded soldiers, and he didn't mention anything about the contractors, from which the big secret is leaking out that it sounds like there's as many fighting contractors as there are soldiers there.
It
so
does.
Why is it such a big secret to not keep statistics on how many them have been killed and amputated?
I don't think the Bush crime family wants it known.
Well, that's the point, though. So Hamilton is supposed to be the Democrat representative on this farce committee, and so he should be the one that's pulling this stuff out. By him ignoring it, it just makes me believe he's part of it.
Well, he is part of it. Lee Hamilton has never been someone who sought the truth, whether it was about Iran-Contra or this horrible situation going on because Bush is insane. Lee Hamilton is a Democratic enabler. He is he works in very close quarters, I guess is the way to put it, with Republicans of the establishment variety. Now, Lee Hamilton nor James Baker would have anything to do with the PNAC crowd, with the neoconservatives, or the religious right. That's not what they're about. What Hamilton and Baker, what they are about is establishment politics with a rightward drift. Lee Hamilton is as much of a Democrat as I am a Republican. He's an establishment politician enabler. He's the type of guy who you call on when you want something that will appear to be bipartisan and run by the lords of discipline in Washington. And that's what these guys are. They're the lords of discipline. And what they are supposed to be doing here is sending a message to this jerk in the White House that his antics, his frat boy antics, have pissed off the one organization on the planet that will not be pissed off, and that is the Washington power establishment. So, no, Lee Hamilton is not a Democrat the way I'm a Democrat, or I assume the way you're a Democrat. He is not.
It just gets me as soon as I hear it, though. I mean, within seconds, I could think he's left something out. Why aren't professionally trained journalists who go to school and and learn how to be a journalist and ask questions. How come people aren't asking these questions?
I don't
know.
That,
where's the other half? You're only showing us half of this story.
I don't know. If you were there, Lee, if I were there, we would ask these questions. And I have no idea. Cowardice? Ignorance? I don't know. Fear that if they ask the Prime Minister of the UK and the President of the United States pointed definite questions that somehow they'll be scolded and spanked? I don't know, Lee. I wish I did. But you raise some good questions.
Okay, talk to you later.
All right, man. Thanks for checking in. We'll talk again. Take
Bye.
Care. We'll be right back.
Justice and the American way. It's more of Mike Malloy.
It is 26 before the hour. Back to your phone calls. Who do we have? Steve is calling from Vancouver, British Columbia. Hey, Steve.
Hey. Really good to hear you back on the line, Mike.
It's Thank you. Appreciate it.
About Clinton's goal in Iraq. Isn't it clear that his goal there is to have a complacent government and a complacent people?
Now, wait, you're saying Clinton's goal?
Bush's goal.
Bush's goal is to have what?
A complacent government to American interests and a complacent people.
Yeah, exactly. A puppet government and happy little Iraqis wandering around doing minimum wage labor to enrich the oil companies and the security companies and the mineral companies and the whatever.
But he never says that. He never says what his goal is.
Well, you don't expect George W. Bush to make that kind of a statement.
Of course not, no.
And certainly, in fairness, I have to add that you wouldn't expect any politician, Republican or Democrat, to be that blatantly honest.
No.
That you know, when you take a look at the beginnings of American imperialism, which I've said before, I think that the historians will agree with this, date from the Spanish Spanish-American War, the turn of the 19th century to the 20th, at the very beginning, it was never about liberating or bringing democracy or representative government or yada, yada, yada. It was always about expanding markets, which is the fundamental need for capitalism.
Exactly.
The markets have got to continue to expand, and there has to be a source of raw materials. Now, that's not necessarily true anymore here because we don't make anything anymore.
No. So what happens with America now when you lose your middle class?
When we lose our middle class, which is happening, we will become like Iraq.
Or worse.
or worse, and then somebody will come here to liberate us, and maybe the Canadians will.
I don't think so. I don't think our military is up to that.
Well, probably not. But all right, well, thanks.
Thanks. I'll talk to you again.
All right, Steve. Appreciate you checking in. There is a very good, quick essay in the current issue of The Nation that I got in the mail today about just what he was talking about. The destruction of, or definitions of working class and middle class. And I don't have it in front of me, so I can't think of the writer's name, but it's very quick. It's a part of a series that The Nation is running by this particular writer. Oh, my goodness, look who's here. Marge!
Hey, ¿cómo va, paisano?
Bueno. I don't know what the hell you said. I have no idea.
I said, how are you, friend?
I know you said that. I know you
All
said
right.
That.
I was looking to see if I could come sleep on your couch.
What's the
matter? They're bringing in the brass monkeys around these parts.
Oh, it is cold up there, isn't it?
Oh, geez. Is it ever?
You know, we lived in Chicago, Kathy and I, for 3.5 years,
mm-hmm.
and we realized that there are two seasons there. There is August and winter.
Yeah, you got that right.
And so I feel for you, Kathy. As a matter of fact, Kathy told me tonight that the temperature in Chicagoland was approaching absolute zero, where molecular atomic activity all stops.
Well, I don't know if it's quite that cold. The wind chill is down to zero. I think the actual air temperature is low teens, I think.
The real reason you...
I don't really care. It's cold out there.
I know.
Oh, geez. You know, your caller, a couple of calls ago, where was he from, New York? Too bad he wasn't around to read your buddy Eric Zorn's column. What was it, Monday or Tuesday?
Oh, yeah?
He had a big, long discussion. I don't know if you heard about it. About Christmas and not the reason for the season, but a reason for the season, mm-hmm. as opposed to the winter solstice and all that good stuff. He caused all kinds of consternation. Jeez.
Oh, I'll bet he did. Well, Eric Zorn, for those who don't know, is a columnist and a friend for the Chicago Tribune. I'll have to go online and find that one.
It's either Monday or Tuesday. I forget which.
Okay.
And the other thing, you're talking about Iraq. There's a column by Richard Cohen. He writes mm-hmm. for the Washington Post, if you're familiar with him.
Yeah.
And he was talking about the encounter between Bush and Webb.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a line in there that almost to the end, it says, where he's talking about the people and how they feel about Bush and his thoughts and whatnot. He says, their only hope is that Bush is a liar rather than a fool. Doesn't that sort of sum it up? I mean, holy crap on a crutch.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, this is our leader. Our leader?
Yeah, I know. I have to just add a postscript to what you're saying, and that is that I 75% of the time have serious doubts about the motives of Richard Cohen. But on the other hand, yeah, somebody mentioned that column to me.
I'm not that familiar with him, but the line, you know, they would rather he be a liar than a fool, and that's a hell of a choice.
Oh, I know. It's but that's what we've got, isn't it, Marge?
Yeah, unfortunately.
I think he's both.
Yeah, well, I wish I could give him credit, but these cartoonists never sign anything so that you can read their signature.
I know.
There's an editorial cartoon that's got it's the map of Iraq as a hole in the ground. And there's Papa Bush with a rope pulling a tot. And he says, George, it's Daddy. Hold on tight.
Oh my God.
Uncle Jim and Uncle Bob are on their way.
Oh, my God.
You know, and then they're sitting in front of Congress today, and they said, this is not fruit salad where you can pick and cheese.
Mm-hmm.
And we've got to reduce a plan to reassess the things that are going on in Iraq to fruit salad so that we can make this idiot understand?
Probably.
Oh, my.
Probably.
Dear God in heaven.
Marge, it is the most astonishing thing that I've ever witnessed in my lifetime, and I have seen, I'm talking about politically, and I have lived through Lyndon Johnson, I have
mm-hmm.
lived through Richard Nixon, and I've never seen anything like George W. Bush. He makes his father look like those 4 years were a period of grace and pleasantness.
You know, most men, when they're in the White House after a few years, you look at their picture the day they took office, and you look at their picture when, you know, getting close to their end of their term, and there seems to be the weight of the job showing on their face.
Yes.
It doesn't seem to make a difference with him. You know, there's nothing there.
It's kind of like Reagan. Reagan was his greatest acting job in all those years that
mm-hmm.
he was an actor was to play the role of the President of the United States. And he played it so well that Democrats were seduced by him, and as he systematically destroyed the unions in this country, union members were voting for him. Because he was a pretty man, and he was had a very pleasant face. And,
every time I think of him, I think of him when he started out in his wherever he was the president of the Screen Actors Guild.
Yeah, in Hollywood, and but at the same
and
time,
and then he got into the White House, and because the air traffic controllers, oh my blood pressure's going up, wanted an increase in salary and better working conditions. You know, because it's a very high-stress job. He fired him. The whole damn lot of them, he fired him.
Reagan's job, his only job, was to be a union buster. Now, keep in mind also, I'm sure you know this, that when he was the president of the Hollywood chapter of the Screen Actors Guild, he was also an informant for the FBI. This was back during the Red Scare days where people like Elia Kazan, and other writers and directors and filmmakers were accused of being part of the Red Scare, the Red Conspiracy. And, of course, Kazan was one of the people who ratted out his fellow Hollywoodites. And for that reason, even though he was a great film director, a lot of folks did not like him. But
it was a lot of years before he went back to work, wasn't it?
That's right. But Reagan was a snitch. He was a snitch, which even in prison, or I should say in prison, is the lowest of the low. He was a snitch. He would rat out other members of his union to Herbert Hoover. They would have private meetings, private phone calls. Ronald Reagan was a sneak, a snitch, a liar, and at the time claimed to be a registered Democrat.
If you look around, I think you will. People will take note if they think about it. Since that bunch has come, you know, Reagan and on down have taken over the world, that the corporations that have had financial difficulties, had filed bankruptcy, and all sorts of things, are the ones where there were major unions involved. The air traffic controllers, for one. The airline pilots and the various unions in the, because there's several different unions in the airline industry and in the auto industry and and now we're lucky, I think, what, 12 million? If there's that many in union jobs nowadays.
That's
where you have.
I read something today that the UAW is going to wind up with about 400,000 members. And I can remember just a few years ago, they had 1.7 million. Hey, listen, I got to go, Marge. Thanks a lot.
Okay, one real quick thought. It's been a whole year since I quit smoking.
Good for you. Good for you.
Remember when they reamed out my carotid?
Yes.
One whole year. And it rose on me, Mother.
Good for you, Marge.
Take care. Hi, Kathy.
We'll talk to you later.
Bye-bye.
I don't hear the burrows talking to me. I don't see things their way. I'm on the right side, I'm on the right side, the only side.
It's about 10 before the hour, thanks to our usual crew of bandits and reprobates, Ian Huff, engineered the program in Phoenix, and answered your calls. Chris in Minnesota is our senior correspondent, Mark Marshall, and the militant mods at MikeMolloy.com. Thank you, Ben Birch, WhiteRoseSociety.org archives the program. Podcasts and downloads are available at NovaMradio.com. See if we can squeeze in some more calls here. Gordon is calling from Oklahoma City. Hey, Gordon, haven't heard from you for a while.
It has been a while, and I have to follow Marge. That's tough.
It is. Marge is unique.
Yes, she is. I thought you'd get a kick out of this story. About 14 or 15 years ago, there was a group of very prominent Muslims in Oklahoma City area that most of them were specialist physicians, heart surgeons, and one of them was well known for doing heart transplants, but they wanted to build a mosque. Mm-hmm. And the community is a little community north of Oklahoma City named Edmond.
Mm-hmm.
this community, just to give you a little background on it, was one that just boomed overnight because of busing and all the white flights. So that kind of gives you a little idea of what we're dealing with here.
Right.
These people went bonkers when they found out a mosque was going to be built there.
Mm.
And, of course, the physicians, they tried everything, you know, to present themselves in a favorable light. But, of course, the good Christians up in Edmond, they denied that any of this had to do with any kind of religious intolerance. They said that the reason that they're opposing this mosque was that, they're afraid it might give the wrong perception that it would be a lot of political activity going on out of that mosque.
Mm-hmm.
But get this, I hope you're sitting down. One of the largest churches in that town, the minister of that church, was running for governor. But that kind of fizzled out when his wife wasn't too willing to share, let's say, her husband's affections with him.
You know, that just cracks me up, Gordon, because if there are any hotbeds of political activism in the United States, it is in these so-called Christian churches that are run by some of the weirdest people I think ever to wind up behind a pulpit. I love hearing a good sermon, even though I don't believe any of this, and I am not a deist. I still enjoy a good sermon. I like to go to church occasionally. I like to attend a black church here in Atlanta, whose name I shall not call out, but I like the music. I like the hymns. It's very inspiring. I certainly enjoy it. But what I have found, especially here in the South, and I think this works for Oklahoma too, is that some of the most rabid attack dog political ideas that advocate war and death and destruction and are found in Christian churches.
The only
difference I find, Gordon, I'm sorry to interrupt, the only difference I find is that the Christian churches haven't reached the point yet where they talk, as some Muslim mosques do around the world, of martyrdom, where they suggest to their members that they strap explosive devices to their body and go see Jesus. You know, that's the only difference I can see in the Christian fanatics and the Muslim fanatics is that the Christians have yet to blow themselves up and get their heavenly reward.
Yeah, I agree with you on that. The one thing that I've been kind of leery of, as far as the Christian churches in this town and around the country, really, is, and I know there's a lot of real good liberal theologians out there.
Sure.
But I take issue with a lot of these fanatical churches because instead of having a true minister, they have a politician up there in the pulpit.
Sure, absolutely.
And I would encourage people, and my views on religion are somewhere probably even beyond you or Richard Dawkins even, you know.
Whoa.
If somebody, you know, I would call for people to get out of these radical right-wing rapture right nutty churches like that caller from New York and go to a liberal church. You know, consider something like the UCC or Universal Unitarians or one of those. On their way out the door, at least consider that perhaps all of this is mythology.
Yeah.
But if they can't wrap their mind around that, at least get into somebody that is at least halfway sensible.
Go, yeah. If one chooses to follow the idea or subscribe to the idea of a creator, why not develop a belief and a faith where the creator is benevolent, where the avatar or avatars of that creator preach love and compassion and understanding and collectiveness, inclusion. You know, I that's the part I can't understand. Every single religion I have ever come up against and I mean that the way I said it, is a religion that that preaches exclusivity, that preaches damnation if you don't follow their belief system, horrible damnation. They don't just condemn your earthly presence, but they condemn your soul for all eternity. And to those people, I just raise the middle finger and give them the atheist salute. I couldn't care less about their religious dogma, but you know, that's the kind of thing I always look for. Is spiritually or emotionally uplifting approach to that subject. Hey, Gordon, thanks for checking in. Don't be a stranger, all right?
Okay, thanks, Mike.
All right, sir, take care. Thanks, everybody. I'll see you tomorrow night, okay? Take care. Keep it lit. I'm Mike Malloy. This is Nova M Radio Network.